Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
And now a conversation that's going to resonate for a lot of people, according to polls. It's about being mixed race. A Pew Research Center poll back in 2015 found the number of multiracial Americans growing at 3 times the rate of the general population. Well, Julie Lithcott-Hames, a former dean at her alma mater, Stanford, has some thoughts about what they might face. 2 years ago, she wrote the wildly popular How to Raise an Adult about overprotective parents. Much of her 2017 book is about her white mother and her black father, and how maybe they didn't protect her, a mixed-race kid, enough, and how she's now raising a mixed-race kid of her own. Julie grew up in an all-white town in Wisconsin. Someone scrawled the N-word on her locker. It was only when she got to a black cotillion that she realized girls with black mothers knew how to handle their hair. In college, she actually wrote the paper that helped clear the way for biracial adoptions, which had been discouraged until recently. But it took her a while to love her own biracial self. Julie Lithcott-Hames' book is Real American. It's out in paperback this week. It's one of our favorite conversations. And we asked her last year how she wanted to start it to identify her.
My identity is solidly black, with biracial as a factual component of it. I finally located a self I could love within blackness. Mm. Biracial was an important term for me when it first came out in the late 80s, because previously we hadn't known what to call people like
right.
me. It finally was a way to stop ignoring my white mother. But as I say in the book, it was a fleeting lover. What I was really hungering for was simply to find a sense of belonging within the black community. And when I found it, it was probably one of the greatest embraces I've ever felt.
As you write in the very beginning of the book, I am the woolly-haired, medium brown-skinned offspring typical when blacks and whites have sex, which was considered illegal in 17 of the 50 United States in 1966. Your parents went ahead and got married anyway in Nigeria in 1967. It's hard to remember what a scandal that might have been.
It was a scandal.
But you become this girl in the 70s growing up who, you know, you put your streamers in your bike on the 4th of July, and your mother seems to be so open to your blackness. But
yeah.
What?
The conventional wisdom at the time was mixed-race biracial children need to be raised with a black identity because the world will see them as black, America will treat them as black, and they need to know that and be black and proud. So my parents did a lot of speaking to that, but they chose to raise me in white towns, which meant I didn't have peers, I didn't have teachers, I didn't have mentors, I didn't see people like me in my town, in my school. And so there was a hollowness to the "you are black" declaration my parents made, and I was a bit bewildered, particularly to hear my white mother say this. I could see that it was this deliberate effort she was making, and she wasn't just play acting. She had lived in West Africa. She cared deeply about Africans. She cared about African Americans when my folks moved here in 69. She had a consciousness around the diaspora and Pan-African issues that most white folks in America didn't then have. And yet, even though she'd read all the studies about black children need black dolls to be healthy psychologically, she didn't go the much more necessary steps further, which would have included towns with a critical mass of black folks, schools with a critical mass. So that aspect of my upbringing was really severely lacking.
Well, and the microaggressions and the macro. You know, you had a girlfriend, you're over playing at her house, and she comes and says to you, "Hey, my sister was visiting when you guys first moved here. She saw your dad riding a lawnmower, and she said, 'Oh, look, they have a black gardener.'"
And yeah, and he'd just stepped down from being Assistant Surgeon General for President Jimmy Carter.
Or on another occasion, you're swimming in a neighborhood pool. Mm. What fun. And somebody's father comes?
Yeah. When I was about 7, living in Rockland County, New York, I was in the above-ground swimming pool at a friend's house and with a bunch of other kids. And apparently, one kid's father got wind of the fact that I was in the pool polluting it with my blackness. And he came to the door and said he wanted to bring his child home. My friend's mother, who stood at the door, apparently gave him quite a tongue-lashing, which I'm grateful for, even though I was never there to observe it. But the father was undeterred. He came and rescued his boy from the pool that had been polluted by the presence of little old black me.
Yeah. Look, at one point you ask as a child, why'd you move me to this all-white town?
Well, You know, I don't actually say it. I wished I'd said, why'd you move me to this all-black town?
Right. It's a thought bubble. Right.
And I couldn't ask it, is the thing. So I adored my daddy. He was smart and accomplished and influential and loved me. And so when he saw this photo of a friend had taken of me with this boy who I had a crush on, this white boy in my high school, which was filled with white people, my daddy says, white boys will be your friend, but they'll never date you. And I couldn't say to him then, why the heck did you move me here? Don't I deserve to be loved, Daddy? Why did you make this choice?
Talk about when things started to change. I mean, there's so much here, so I'm going to take you through your high school and college years. People don't think you belong in Stanford. I mean, there's a white professor that's a good friend of yours. He says, oh, you're a twofer, a woman and a black. In other words, the insult that you were just filling quotas, two of them.
When I got into Harvard Law School, yeah.
These people betraying you in some ways. You thought they were your friends. But take us to the point where it starts to change for you. Because you yourself were sort of embarrassed about your blackness, if I've kind of got that right.
Sure. You know, so I'm, by now in the story, I'm a dean at Stanford University. I'm the dean of freshmen. I'm the associate vice provost for undergraduate education. That's an important role. An executive coach has been brought in to work with five or six of us. We're not getting along well with each other, and the coach is there to help us. And when she was able to deliver, ready to deliver my 360-degree feedback, the feedback kind of rang out like this. Too loud, too pushy, too aggressive, too emotional, too impulsive, too angry. And I thought, are you freaking kidding me? This is the dictionary definition of the angry black woman. I am being stereotyped as I'm being told how to improve my behavior. And my lovely executive coach, who was a white Buddhist Aikido master, she looked at me and smiled and she said, how's that working for you? And I looked at her and I said, not very well. She nodded and smiled. She said, what if you got a handle on when the feelings were coming so you could decide, do I want to respond or not? If I do want to respond, how do I want to respond? What I learned as I began to notice the feelings as they were coming up, to be able to stop them and interrogate them, I began to realize they come when I'm feeling disregarded, disrespected, dissed, you know, and that for me is rooted in this fear that this comment this other person is making is like 1, 2, 3, 5 steps away from them calling me the N-word. Mm. Now, I'm not saying they wanted to call me the N-word. I'm saying the psychological corrosiveness of the microaggressions from my childhood into my adulthood had made me fear that that was possible again.
There was also a part of you that recognized, yeah, I am an angry black woman. There's things to be angry at. For instance, yeah. There's that meeting where a white woman, you were wearing your hair naturally. For so many years, you'd straighten it with a curling iron. You're wearing your hair naturally. And she starts touching it.
She puts her hands on it and starts to toss it like a salad or like bounce it like a beach ball. And I back away and I look at her fiercely in the eye and I say, you can't do this. This is a thing that white women do to black women. You can't do this. Don't pet me. Yeah. And the other women, I'm appealing with my eyes to a woman I thought knew better to say, please help me. Please help me. Do not make me have to fight this alone. Don't make me out to be the crazy one here, folks.
Yeah. Well, you come to the point where you realize you're not reacting enough to the real world that your children are growing up in. You question, you know, what have I done? Have I done the same thing, marrying what sounds like this wonderful white man? What's your answer?
I'm trying to build in them the kind of self-love around their existence as people of color that I lacked. I'm trying to talk really frequently and openly about the various issues we contend with as people of color. You know, my daughter is light enough that she's got her arm around her brother. She gets these kinds of questions. Who's that guy? Are you dating him? Because they don't match skin tone. Or I come to pick her up in an event. Who's that lady? She's my mother. She's your mother? So she's constantly told she doesn't match her own family. And boy, that happened to me too with my white mom. And so I hope I've created in them a greater consciousness than I had. I hope I've given them a foundation of love so they love themselves. So that when the, you know, what hits the fan, if it does, that they know they have someone to turn to, their mom, that they know they can also turn to their dad, who's an incredibly woke white man, and fundamentally be embraced, be listened to, be believed, and then supported, and then reinforced with strength to get back out there into America.
You have a message that you deliver close to the end of the book. Okay. I wonder if you could just read that.
I am drawn like a magnet to the little fuzzy-headed brown-skinned kids with white parents whom I see in restaurants, in airports, in malls. My body wants to go near. My soul wants to be a friend to a child who might be feeling lost on an island. Instead, I smile deeply at the children and at the parent. If the parent doesn't get why I'm smiling, I hope he or she will think, why is that woman smiling at me? What is she saying with that smile? I'm saying, please read up on this. Please have black friends. Please don't make the mistakes my parents made. Please build some belonging to community. Please give this kid a chance to develop a healthy self. If the hair is done right, I compliment the parent.
Julie Lithcott-Hames, her new book, Real American, is about growing up black and biracial. Julie, thank you so much.
Robin, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Julie Lithcott-Hames' Real American is now out in paperback.